You're listening to Augmented Humanity. Our guests are modern explorers working at the intersection of technology and the humanities. They help us to understand ourselves and the worlds we create in this digital age. They are thinkers, creators, makers, and academics working in diverse fields like geography, the visual arts, performing arts, storytelling, and literature. I'm your host, Craig Goldsmith.
I'm your host, Ellen Dornan.
On this program, we're joined by Dr. Shannon McSheffrey, a medieval historian at Concordia University in Montreal. Professor McSheffrey's research interests center around law, mitigation, gender roles, civic culture, marriage, literacy, heresy, and popular religion in late medieval England. She has published a number of scholarly articles and 5 books. We're also joined by Dr. John Wyatt Greenlee, a medievalist and cartographic historian who recently completed his doctorate at Cornell University, where he wrote his dissertation on eels in the cultural landscape of medieval and early modern England.
It's such a pleasure for me to be here today with two of the people who are making my favorite part of the internet. I just want to spend a little bit of time talking about how you do it. Both of you employ humor. I've seen you employ juicy clickbait headlines, that sort of great internet lead-in of, oh, and then he murdered again. So what do you all find is really important for getting people's attention or for getting people engaged when you're telling these little tiny, beautiful stories on Twitter?
I think there's a couple things, for me at least. You have to start with something that's at least interesting one way or another to you. If it's not interesting to me, then I have a really hard time making it interesting to other people. And then I rely, as you said, very heavily on humor. And so trying to think of a way to frame the bit of research that I've got in front of me in a way that will make people either notice or laugh or sometimes be surprised. And I work with medieval eel rents, and we're talking about numbers of eels in like hundreds of thousands. And so that gets surprising sometimes to people. So yeah, sort of thinking about ways to take the very small research nugget I've got and make it interesting. And readability, I try to make tweets very readable by breaking them into short sentences that are separated by spaces, so line breaks, so they're much easier to read than like a block paragraph.
John has hit a number of really crucial things. I've been working at academic writing now for 3 decades, and I always find that I'm continuing to learn to write, but doing a lot of Twitter has really helped me refine how to be pithy. Pithiness is absolutely the heart of Twitter. And I, like many academic writers, have a tendency to be wordy. You know, you have to fit into the 280 characters in one tweet. That's one of the things I actually quite like about it, is that like really thinking better in more clear terms about reaching your audience and thinking hard about how it is to convey things in an effective way.
Whether it's retweets or whether it's the fresh, pithy take on the subject material at hand, do you compose these carefully before you post them, or do you ever just whip out the phone and sort of just type as you go the way some people do into Twitter? Are these carefully articulated, edited before you put them out there, even if it's only 280 characters or less?
Depends on what I'm tweeting, I guess. For most of the day when I'm tweeting things, it's much more sort of ad hoc. But each weekday, I tweet an eel history tweet, sort of a more formal one. And that takes time and consideration and sort of planning and writing. And as Shannon was saying earlier, it's hard writing. I very often will write the tweet and then realize I'm, you know, 400 words over. And how do you shrink that back down in a way that doesn't just fit what you want to get on the page, but makes it, as Shannon said, pithy and interesting. And so those take sort of more planning and thought. And then usually I'll attach a meme or an image to them, and finding the image that I want to use, writing the meme, if that's what I'm using, also takes time. So for those, the sort of one a day, here's your eel history tweet of the day kind of tweet, those are much more composed and careful.
Yes, and same with me. And I just borrow other people's memes. I don't create them the way that John does. But searching for images, I mean, that was one of the things as I went back and looked at my early Sanctuary Seeker of the Day. I didn't necessarily use images that often. And it soon became clear to me that the image is a really important part of a tweet. When I see a medieval image, I know, oh, well, that's not something about the President of the United States. It's about the Middle Ages. So my feed, like I imagine almost everybody, studies is mixed up with all sorts of stuff, right? Trying to find the right images was something that actually did take quite a long time to be able to find good images and figure out, you know, how I was going to go about it. At one point, I began to realize that the paintings, especially of Peter Bruegel, were gold mines. For me, being able to find, you know, late medieval, early modernish people doing things, because he's got so many different people doing things in his paintings, and I could just take little snippets of them. That became one of my methods.
I have a question, just because you brought up how mixed up all our Twitter feeds are. I know that there is bleed between the medieval and the current political situation. And John, I just want to bring up why your Twitter feed blew up the other day. And for those who are listening, this program was recorded right after the New York Times published the first article about the president's taxes. And you translated his $750 that he paid in taxes into what the equivalent would have been in medieval eel rents. Some paltry, 1,100 eels or something like that, right?
I don't remember the exact number, but yeah.
People sort of piled on and looked at how many eels would it cost for the president to have covered his hairdressing bills, for example, or how many eels does he owe? And I don't know whether that was one of your carefully composed tweets or whether you just had your eel rent calculator and you were like, yeah.
It's one of the weird things about Twitter, I guess, is that the things you don't necessarily expect to blow up do, and vice versa sometimes. That was something I dashed off right before dinner. Several years ago, out of curiosity, and because it's interesting, I had done the what does a medieval eel get you in today's currency kind of calculation. It's on my website. It's a fun little resource. It's very back of the napkin. I wouldn't put it in an academic paper or anything, but it's useful for things like that. You can say, well, you know, like his $70,000 that he's spending on his hair is like 115,000 eels. Like, that's a lot of eels.
What size eels? I mean, you're talking like fist length, arm length?
Probably about arm length is fair. Most of the eel rents are due in silver eels, so they're like the full-size adult ones. Those are migrating back down to sea. So arm length, 6 to 12 pounds.
Okay, I've got a picture.
It gives you grist for your next nightmare.
Yes, exactly.
You had asked about the people sort of latching onto that, and those are places where you can give people a different framework. And it's funny, right? You think it's like 1,100 eels is what he pays in taxes every year. That's a very standard peasant rent for medieval England. It's like 1,000 or 1,500 eels. And so even medieval peasants are paying more in eels than this guy's paying. So it's a nice reframing, and it caught. So you never really know what's going to catch.
Yeah. You were talking about this, Shannon, and then Ellen talked about things being mixed up. I'm definitely curious, do you all separate your personal tweets from your professional tweets? A lot of these tweets are you speaking as historians, as credentialed members of academic institutions. Do you also just in the same Twitter feed, do you tweet about pie you made yesterday, or do you have separate personal accounts for those sorts of things?
I tend to use Facebook for the pies, and Twitter, I don't do very much personal stuff, really. You know, I made a choice that my Twitter was mostly going to be about research things. I follow all kinds of things that are about other stuff. Once I realized that my students were mostly not following me, like that they didn't think that Twitter was about academic things and they didn't want academic things fouling up their timeline, right? Then I decided that, you know, I could, for instance, retweet things that relate to politics and stuff like that, that I might have been a little bit more reluctant to do otherwise. Every once in a while, I probably tweet something that is political or says that, you know, my provincial government in Quebec is doing something silly related to pandemic or something like that. But mostly I do the scholarly stuff. What about you, John?
Mine's just a big hodgepodge. So sometime in the morning, I'll do a eel tweet of the day. But the rest of the day, it's really kind of mixed. My kids are really funny, I think. So I tweet a lot of things that my kids say and, you know, other random things going on. But I think Shannon touched on something important. It comes down to choices, right? So the choice that I made was I really only had time in my life for one social media platform. And so Twitter was it. And I think when I started using Twitter consistently, I was much more hesitant about sort of mixing up personal and professional. But at this point, I don't really care. I'm very careful with what I share about my kids and my family, but I'm not too concerned about the sort of bleed between the two of them because I'm sort of thinking of it in terms of reflection of who I am. You know, I'm a historian and dad and a whole bunch of other things. And so people get to see that. I think it's useful that I don't just appear as an academic because I want to talk to people who are not academics. And it's useful if they can see that I'm having, you know, a fight with my kid's school board over something.
Lots of people are very personal on Twitter, and I have no problem with that. I don't think it's unacademic or anything like that. I'm not especially like that because that is actually a reflection of who I am, that I'm not a sharer, let's just say. So I think that Twitter is so many different things. I mean, my children who are in their early 20s have completely different things mostly showing up on their Twitter feeds than what is on mine, except there are obviously the crossovers where we're all seeing things about the pandemic and we're all seeing stuff, even in Canada, tremendous amounts of stuff about American politics. And we get Canadian politics too.
Sorry about that.
Yeah. Well, I guess I could probably try to block phrases and stuff like that, but it would be extremely hard, I think, to take that off.
This might be sort of a final question for this last segment. The stuff that you're putting on your Twitter feeds, especially as it relates to your work as historians, may not be the stuff upon which resumes are built, but are there mechanisms for saving and archiving these tweets? Like, I'm thinking in particularly the Sanctuary Seekers. I mean, that's almost like a real project. It just happened to take place on Twitter. So is there a mechanism for you to capture those tweets should you ever, say, want to republish them or recontextualize them? Or did you save the images and texts that you put up or do screen grabs or anything like that? Or would you just have to go scroll through your own river?
When I was doing the Sanctuary Seekers series, I realized that I was looking through manuscripts and stuff like that to come up with the material that I was doing. So it was real research, and that it was going to, in effect, be kind of lost in the river. So I did create a website, sanctuaryseekers.ca, that effectively captures and updates. I mean, one of the things was some of those posts then engendered discussion from people who had found other things that were relevant or something like that. And so, you know, I can update, in a sense, that discussion. And in order to create that, it was necessary to go through the Twitter feed to bring that stuff into a form in this website. You know, I'm hoping that John's material is effectively woven into his thesis and will be part of the book that he will publish. I was doing it after I had written the book, and I'm doing a little bit of tweeting on the book that I'm writing now, but doesn't seem as suited in a sense for the Twitter format. But John's stuff, I'm hoping, is going to make its more indelible form, I guess, in the scholarly publications.
I hope so, too. Most of the material that I tweet is from the research I've done for my dissertation, a database of 1,500 or so separate pieces of eel history. Most of the time, I'm kind of picking from them and trying to tell an interesting story from one of them. I didn't start out trying to manage my tweets because it started with me doing just sort of one-offs, like, oh, here's this funny thing I found in the archives and share it. And then it sort of worked up to the point when I'm doing it once a day. So at this point, I built a database to sort of keep track of which of these little bits of facts I had been sharing. And the meme I used, make sure I'm not retelling the same story like a month later, which is sometimes really hard to remember. Was it a month ago or 6 months ago or 8 months ago? If it was 6 or 8 months ago, then maybe I want to retell it because there are people who don't remember it or didn't see it, or I've added new followers. At this point, I've got a database to help me keep track of those tweets. And I'm sure that there are probably sort of third-party apps that will do that for you, but I just built my own.
Because yeah, at a certain point, it becomes a project in and of itself.
But there's no magic wand to just pull your whole feed.
Especially if you're doing 365 eel tweets a year.
I don't do weekends. So,
okay. But still, it builds up rapidly. And yeah, there's no way you can remember exactly what you might have said or not said. Well, this has just been a really, really fascinating discussion.
Thank you both so much. You just broadened our horizons tremendously. And I just want to say, for anybody who's squeamish around eels, the pictures of the cute baby elvers, they will warm the cockles of your eel-fearing heart and you will change your attitudes.
Well, thank you. This has been really enjoyable.
Absolutely. Thank you for having us.
And if you would like more information and to follow these Twitter feeds, you can go to twitter.com and follow @MedievalMcChef. That's spelled M-C-S-H-E-F-F @MedievalMcChef, and follow @GreenleeJW. We also have more links up at our webpage. Augmented Humanity is a program of the New Mexico Humanities Council, produced in partnership with KUNM-FM. You can visit us online and find out more about our programs at nmhumanities.org. Our theme music comes courtesy James Whiten, and we've had production assistance from Tristan Klum.